And we just had a break because one of Billy's family came in, and so can you start your thought again?
No, I was just going to say, I think the bottom line to that example is that leadership is everything. There's all different types. I mean, some people are, you know, authoritative. Some people are, you know, you build from below and groundswell. Some of it's by example. Some of it is by, you know, the people skills, whatever. But that's the key. You have organization, and you have hopefully more than one leader, you know, but a great team has three or four leaders on it. You know, a good team maybe has one leader. If you don't have any leaders, you're not going to get there. You're just not going to make it.
That's an interesting perception, especially the multiple leader situation. And that's educating me as well. Let's go back to the childhood. I think that I remember you not being quite involved with your age peers, but creating your own peer group.
Yeah, I think that was part of it. I think the biggest thing for me, you know, quite frankly, I was, you know, I grew up with kind of an interesting scenario because my mom came from a fairly, you know, wealthy family. Her dad, she was an only child. Her dad was in the construction business. I mean, growing up, a couple of the buildings in town had his name on a cornerstone, which I always thought was kind of neat.
Which buildings? I'm sorry, Bill. I didn't know this.
One was the original Pierce School.
Wow.
Another one was the Brookline Public Library.
You're kidding me.
The original one.
You never told me. You never told me this.
No, I didn't. And like I said, I just. But anyway, from my mom's family, again, just an only child. Her parents got married late in life. But that was part of the Brookline thing with me. We lived in a nice neighborhood. I grew up with a lot of, you know, successful people around you. My dad, on the other hand, he was from New Brunswick, huge family.
Wait a minute, New Brunswick, Canada?
Yeah, New Brunswick, Canada.
Which is where I moved to.
I'm sorry?
Which is where I moved to.
Yeah, it's a small world.
Wow, I didn't.
But he came down with his brother. They didn't have a lot of money. They were farming people up there.
And lumber.
And he came down, lied about his age. He was too old to enlist in the Army, but lied about his age, got in, and served in World War II. Tough guy, very serious guy. Taught me, you know, different values. I remember we used to go for walks in Brookline. Went up the street and he says, okay, if you take a left here, and you remember where we lived, take a left here, a lot of money, a lot of very important people with big titles. You take a right and go down two blocks, and you were right in actually one of the toughest sections of Boston at the time, which was Buswell Street. Usually, a lot of things going on down there at night. It's been replaced now by the Mass Pike, but at the time, as a kid, it was you had railroad cars going by and hobos and the like, and a lot of transient people. But he said the lesson he taught me. He says you go left. And you know, into the high rent district, and a lot of money doesn't necessarily equate to all those people being good people. There's good people and bad people. Just like you go right, and you're in a tough neighborhood, and definitely a lower social class. But again, there's good people in these neighborhoods also, and there's bad people. And the lesson was, don't equate name or how much somebody is worth to whether probably one of my best lessons.
You never showed me that neighborhood on the right, and you know, I think I remember, my parents saying to me, "Okay, be home by 5 o'clock." And what they didn't realize is that for a dime, I could go 25 miles.
Oh yeah.
And I went into the red light district of Boston. It was a different time when kids could be safe.
Oh yeah, well, Boston, it's interesting because, I played in the summer as I got older. I played in the Boston had great, organizations for leagues and teams and everything in baseball. We organized a team. We actually played out of Brighton, Mass. And one night you'd go into Roxbury, and you'd play teams, all the black kids, basically. The next night you might go to South Boston, play all the Irish kids. The next week you'd be in the North End playing the Italian kids, and it was great. I mean, it was you talk about colorblind or socially, you talk about diversity.
It was about the game, wasn't it, Billy?
Exactly, and it was great. You met great people. You had fun. Afterwards, so many of those teams. A lot of them, we'd all sit around and just kind of talk about, baseball, like you and I used to do way back when, And
so you're the black kids from Roxbury, as I remember playing a ball in the YMCA. I was there was only two white kids and the rest were black kids, and we didn't dwell on those color differences.
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
We just
dwell on how good a person performed. And
right.
If they were really good, which was the case with a lot of these different neighborhoods, the end of which you go up and shake hands with them. And, I can remember talking to a couple different people. This was a blast, yeah, awesome,
Yeah.
Great.
Tell me the attitude. I mean, you're talking about a different era, and maybe that era we have lost our way in as a country, and we'll talk about that, and let's try to remember that, because I think this is the seeds of how we've lost our way. I remember me wanting to date one of my father's employees. She happened to be black, and I didn't really care she was black. She was cute, but she said, no, there's no way, and I was going to go to Roxbury anyway, and but there was just no way she would allow me to, but we were good friends, and we enjoyed each other, and she was down in the basement and, doing the pricing, and I would help her out. And it just wasn't the same, how do you describe it? Differentiation other than, it just wasn't the same. And it was, the antagonism wasn't there. Okay. The reverse discrimination and the discrimination wasn't in there in my environment, and I guess it wasn't there in your environment.
No, it wasn't. My dad, always worked in the city in Boston, and it was just like I say. I think for me anyway, from my personal experience, is the fact that we had more common ground. I mean, we were doing things, a lot of things, where you had. Exposure to each other,
Well, look at our immediate peers, okay? You had you as a New Brunswicker, and probably goes back to an indentured servitude to from either Scotland or Ireland, is that correct? And then or royalty. Or royalty, who knows? And then you had Glenn Fulbright, who was, the Aryan from Darien, right?
Yeah.
Then you had Claudio Augustus Caesar Caprio.
That's a mouthful.
Whose, father, was he an engineer too?
Yeah, he was an engineer. He just, basically, he came off, he and his mom came off the boat,
He came off the boat.
Went through Ellis Island and everything, so that was kind of a...
My grandparents came from Russia. where they were being killed as Jews, and you know, during the 1900s, and then you had Richard Briganti, whose father was a handyman and a, you know, had less, but it didn't seem to matter, did it?
No, it didn't.
And then we had Leo Lee, who was a Chinese fellow. This group only missed really having the intimate group having a black kid in it, and not because he couldn't get into it, but he just didn't show up to the field, right?
Right. Well, it's interesting, too, because a couple of those people you mentioned were actually pretty successful in their own right. Leo, that I tend to forget about. Funny story about him, he was just about legally blind, even as a teenager.
I didn't know that.
He ran the ran one of the marathons, the Boston Marathon, and he was such a such a hard guy to understand. But he actually trained for this almost for a year. He said, "I'm going to run in this, and I'm going to finish." And I said, "You got to be out of your mind." I said, "26 miles or whatever it is." I said, "There's no way. I've played sports against you. You're not that fast." And quite frankly, I don't remember you ever even lasting through a game, you know. And lo and behold, not only did he finish the marathon, but he got as much publicity as the person that won it. He finished in about a time of something like 6 hours. And I think after 4 hours, a lot of the people that are out there directing runners and everything, you know, disband. And he ended up taking a wrong turn. Instead of coming down the route, he ended up going down Commonwealth Avenue, and he actually ran about another three-quarters of a mile. So the next day, I was actually shocked to pick up the paper and see this picture of Leo Lee finishing the marathon somewhere around 7 o'clock at night.
Anyway, you must have tortured him for that.
Yeah, well, the funny thing was, I didn't go to too many of my high school reunions. I went to, I think, my 20th, and he was there, and he was like royalty for 10 or 12 of the people there, because he had started an import-export business with China. Needless to say, I guess he was ahead of his time, because he did very well. He was very successful at it. And
I'm not surprised at all that he was successful.
100 people working for him, and he's done well for himself. So
I'm not surprised.
Product of those sports events we had, I guess.
I think the only person we lost touch with is Fulbright. I think everyone's been a success in that group in one way or another.
Yep.
Which is unbelievable to have 100% success. And I, like you, did not relate to the high school experience per se. I remember in the 10th or 15th anniversary, them calling me up and saying, "You're the most successful." I was on TV at the time with Avis and in all kinds of magazines and stuff. "You're the most successful graduate we have. We need to have you come." And I said, "What for?"
Yeah.
I simply didn't like the high school experience. I didn't relate to the kids mostly. And I blossomed before and after. Okay?
Well, that's a key word, really, because that's kind of how I felt also. I just think it's not really important, you know. When you blossom, I mean, some kids they peak out in their little league years, quite frankly, or their high school years, and others, you know, they might be 20s. And some people, I mean, Colonel Sanders was a great example for Kentucky Fried Chicken. He didn't really blossom out until he was in his late 50s, I guess. But doesn't matter when you get there; just keep trying, you know.
And that's kind of what you eat every night, isn't it? Kentucky Fried Chicken. Yeah.
No, I don't actually.
let's talk about your attitude toward authority figures. We've talked a little bit about your dad. Your mom was amazing, and I still love her to death. She, I mean, you'd walk in and say, you know, what do you got to eat? And Ben, you know, within 10 minutes, there'd be a full three-course event.
She's really she's a good person. I think with her, she was a really always so nice to people. I'd like to think that I inherited some of that, but I think
I don't think so.
It was interesting because my mom and my dad were my two. I mean, you know, I'm proud to say they were two of my role models. Unfortunately, I know today a lot of people, you know, list all these famous people or rich people as role models, but for me, I have to actually see somebody or at least be exposed to what they do to really call them a role model. I think we use that term a little bit too loosely today.
You know, I got to be honest with you, Billy. Anytime I needed a boost, I would just come over, and if your mother appeared on the scene,
yep,
she said, "Oh, hi, Richard." It was so positive,
yep,
that it had a impact,
yeah,
on me.
Yep.
And she was just so accepting, and she just made me feel special.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm kind of choked.
A lot of people. She, you know,
And she's still alive, right?
Oh yeah, she's
tough. I'm kind of surprised you didn't name me as a role model, and kind of disappointed, and probably will end the interview. You know,
whatever it takes. She'll be happy. But no, I think that I had some sports figures as role models. The only problem with those people is you really never know them. And a lot of times when you do find out about them later on, you realize that maybe they weren't the best of role models. But,
well, I was at the last, you and I, you know, I had an uncle who had season tickets to the Red Sox, and they never used any. So I'd go out and grab 30 games, and you and I would sit between first and home plate and harass the on-deck batters, and we'd collect autographs like crazy, which my parents have now, my mother threw away, which is worth probably $500,000 in my baseball cards. My mom threw that away. We've gone over your, let me ask you a question, and I'm going to ask you, were you ever distracted and found daydreaming, and did you have big ideas, and if so, did you share them or keep them to yourself?
No, I always daydreamed. I think anybody that tells you they don't have ideas, and if you don't have dreams, I feel for you. I really do, because you got to have, number one, you got to have a little bit of an imagination. You got to have a little bit of belief, even though you can't a lot of times see it coming to fruition, you know, right away or easily. You can't deter away from it, because that to me is what the future is all about. The people that I know that retire and you know, either don't have a lot of friends or don't have a lot of dreams or don't have an imagination to do things, those are the people that are miserable. Those are the people that most times, or a lot of time, I see them going back to work part-time in the job they just finished, you know, or just retired from. And
right,
to me, that's, you know, the sign of you know, really just kind of a shallow existence. I think you want to, you know, no matter what your lot is in life, you need to, you know, reach out and look ahead and say, okay, here's where I want to be. A lot of people are very goal-oriented. I was very goal-oriented. I had a 3-year plan, a 5-year plan. Well, a 5-year plan in these days, you pretty much toss out the window. But I think from a personal standpoint, you want to have goals. You want to have things.
There's no question that I planned, once I stopped the bombing in Laos through turning down my closing my college and couldn't get a recommendation, that I made a plan to go from there to underground irrigation to bread, from earning enough money to bread to start an underground irrigation company to starting a real estate company to ending up as an organic farmer. That was and retirement. This was a clear cut plan that I marched on. Okay. And did my due diligence and marched on it. Without a single inch of wavering. I mean, every entrepreneur and entrepreneur wavers.
Exactly. You're driven, basically.
Oh, my God, was I driven. I mean, when I did real estate, eight out of ten, and underground irrigations, 8 out of 10 contacts with customers would give me a contract or and a deposit. Okay?
Uh-huh.
That's how driven. I would not, there was just no way I was going to leave that home or leave that person without receiving compensation and a move forward to my goal. Was there a person or event? And we've talked about your dad and mom. You've ignored the mighty lion. Was there a person or event of great, and I can say that you were, for me, a great influence in my life. Was there a person or event, and I don't want you to say about me, but was there a person or event of great influence in your life? What impact did this person or event have on your success? We've done your mother and father. Is there anything else?
I've got a couple quick ones I'll give you. My first was applying to go to school in Arizona, going to Arizona State. And when I did it actually kind of for the wrong reasons. I went there to play baseball, you know, because it was, at the time, it was the number one baseball school in the nation.
I didn't know that.
And I thought, quite frankly, that I was pretty damn good. And I didn't want to just play. I wanted to compete against the best. And I remember my dad going absolutely out of his mind because, almost 3,000 miles away.
Right.
I got all the great schools in Boston to pick from.
Right.
And it was very hard. I mean, especially as you referenced early on in this, I wasn't somebody who wanted, you know, very far away from Brookline.
No.
And this was such a huge thing. I remember we had, we really had some heated arguments. I ended up paying for my own schooling, taking out student loans and the like. Granted, it wasn't as expensive back then as it is now, but nonetheless, if you don't have money to begin with, anything's expensive if it costs anything. But that was a huge turning point in my life because, number one, I was out on my own. I knew no one out there. No one was going out there that I knew.
You were out of your comfort zone.
Way out of my comfort zone, which is not a bad thing, by the way.
No.
I think that was huge because I learned a lot. I became self-dependent. I always was confident, but quietly confident. I wasn't a boisterous type of kid. You know, if I wanted something, I went after it.
You left that up to me.
More times than not, I got it. Another turning point was...
Did you play baseball for Arizona?
No, I did not. I got out there, and they had been playing for a month. The competition was at a level that I couldn't even dream about. Reggie Jackson, Sal Bando, Rick Monday.
Wow.
Were all players that were in front of me. The team that was out there, I think 8 of them, within 3 years, were all in the major leagues playing. But the bottom line was I ended up playing some JV ball out there, and it was a great experience. You know, I had fun. I was also taking an engineering load, so it wasn't a cakewalk either.
Did you go to Wentworth first or Arizona first?
I went to Wentworth, which was a junior college back in Boston. I took took aeronautical technology there. And Then transferred out to Arizona and took aeronautical engineering, and ended up taking some summer courses just to fill in some requirements, and then worked for GE, which was also huge because I got to observe and meet Jack Welch, who, especially in the early days, really inspired me from a leadership standpoint. Did a lot of things with people early on, getting everybody together, the working level, the management level, and coming up with new ideas and creative ways to do things. And he was just an incredible, had the opportunity to go to Crotonville, which is their training facility up in Ossining, New York, three or four different times. Met Jack personally several times when he came in to speak, and then had open forums afterwards. And other than my dad, I think he was probably, which is going to shock you, but he was probably the smartest person I ever met, and definitely the most influential. And I just, he was the type of guy that you'd sit there in a room with 100 other people, and you'd basically be hanging on what he was going to say. He just had the ability to present in a way that you felt like he was talking directly to you, and absolutely got me pumped up to take on more responsibility and leadership. And I think that's really kind of what kicked off, you know, you referenced earlier some of the different positions, but right after that I said, you know, I never really wanted to be a manager. I told you earlier there weren't a lot of role models, but he changed all that. And within a period of about 3 or 4 years, he really kind of cut out a lot of the dead wood and really turned things around. And I guess I was part of that, because after sitting and listening to him, I said, you know what, I'm getting a little older now, not playing as many competitive sports, and I've got some time, my kids are getting a little older, I think it's time to click it up a notch. And the rest, it was kind of funny, every years people would be tapping on my shoulder about taking other jobs or taking on other challenges, and I would say that was absolutely a key turning point.
That's a
end of my professional career.
Would you say that he inspired leaders to be leaders?
Oh, absolutely, and more importantly, knocked down a lot of the bullshit, a lot of the red tape, to allow that not only to be a leader, but to take some of the smoke screen away and some of the obstacles away, and encourage you to take risk, to take, you know, opportunities, you know, seize them and run with them, you know.
To take ownership?
I'm sorry?
To take ownership as well?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the ability to succeed and fail? Would you say that he allowed you to fail and therefore succeed?
I think, you know, there would be room
risk
for some misses. I wouldn't say.
Well, I don't mean complete failure.
Don't make it a habit of failing, but I think, he would take, you know, calculate it. He lets you have risk to you know, get the opportunity, and then it's up to you to really drive it to make sure, you know, you do succeed.
Huh. Can you give me some examples to illustrate the challenges you faced at GE once you got out of the comfort zone, the individual comfort zone?
I'll give you a bunch. I think, first of all, there's always in a corporation, there's always a large amount of complacency. You have people that have been there for a long time. You have people that basically do the same thing every day, day in and day out. And very honestly, a lot of them get rewarded for that. And I think that was one of the biggest challenges for me. You know, I can remember taking on jobs like when I transferred to Indiana. And I remember I had to go in and sit down with one of the vice presidents. He was actually the vice president of human resources. And he talked about the plant out there. You know, it was the Midwest, great work ethic. It was a union plant, but they had a great work ethic. And he said, you know, Bill, he said, this plant has never really broken through the eggshell. And I thought it was kind of an interesting comment. In other words, they had made, you know, little changes, but from a corporate standpoint, looking at this area, it was ripe with a great workforce. They had never really had the leadership to radically do something, you know, where it just makes a step change and goes from a good plant to an outstanding plant. And so I said to him, I said, well, I said, not only are we going to crack through the eggshell, we're going to break the eggshell totally. I said, you're talking to the wrong guy if you think, I mean, first of all, if you're a leader, be decisive, not tentative. You know, and one of my things was always have a plan and make sure you share it with people. Now, I would drive.
Wow.
A lot of times, I you know, anytime you get transferred to a new area, you inherit a staff. And some of those people have been there for 20 years doing the same basic role. So one of my things was, hey, right up front, you know, I get to know the human resource person because typically he's the person that is your, you know, connection or has been the connection to the workforce. Now, with me, I didn't believe in that because I believe by manage by walking around. In other words, get out in the shop. I don't care what type of business it is. I don't care if it's a manufacturing business, if it's an engineering business, but walk the area daily. If you got three shifts of people working, walk all three shifts, which means for a lot of these jobs, you know, I'd get in probably at 5:10 in the morning, every morning. And I would leave there probably around 7 o'clock. Now, a lot of people say, well, Jesus, that's 14 hours of work. Well, I got news for you. If you're sitting at the top and you've got a large organization, you damn well better be putting the hours in. Because if you're not there and people, you know, lose sight of you, it's almost like a trust thing. It's a confidence thing with people. Because if they see you, if they know you, if they feel like they can communicate with you, and more importantly, communication isn't just talking to people, it's more listening to people. And I would, every time I had an idea, I would float it. You know, it was like planting seeds in a garden. I'd go around the three shifts. I'd probably go to maybe what I considered 8 or 9 influence people out in the areas. I mean, it could be an hourly worker. It could be a union steward. It could be a salaried worker that people respect. But I would go and I would seed this idea and I'd say, hey, Joan or Jane or Jack, here's what I'm thinking of doing.
Thank God you mentioned Jane.
Huh?
Thank God you mentioned Jane.
Oh, okay. Anyway, I wouldn't, you know, I'd say this is something I'm going to do tomorrow or the next day, but it's something I'm thinking about and I want to do. But I said, I want you to take a look at this thing. Tell me what you think. If it's totally screwed up, tell me how we can basically do the concept, but you make some changes and tell me, you know, the changes to make. So right away, what are you doing? Okay, I'll tell you what I'm doing. I'm alienating my direct staff because, or at least a handful of them. But those aren't the people I want anyway. Because if they're looking at, you know, information as power, and I'm only going to seed some of it out when I want to seed it out, that's not the kind of person I want on my leadership team anyway. If they know something, I want everybody to know it. I want the information flowing, you know, uphill and downhill rapidly. And a lot of people couldn't deal with that. But the end result would be I would get something back because a lot of these people would go and they talk to, you know, some of them would talk to 25 people, but you knew who those people were. Again, the personalities, you know. You'll see some people that, you know, they'll say, well, I got a little piece of information, but don't tell anybody, and then they'll turn around and tell 25 people. Okay? But, you know, I mean, I'm sure all of you have seen people like that, so understand who they are. Understand, you know, you can use those people in a positive way, too. But, so, anyway, I would get, you know, I would get feedback.
Look at some... Anyway, look at some of the achievements. Okay, we're going to continue on, but as I read some of your achievements and try to interact with what you're saying, and I want you to keep that thought. I don't want you to stop there. Okay.
Well, one of the huge achievements, and I won't say I had, I'll say we had, because
right on your resume it says here that you were responsible for a shop cost output of $133 million. And manage over 1,800 SKUs, part numbers, but that you reduced costs by, you said a greater than 50% reduction in MDRs, or what do you say, what do you mean by MDRs?
Mm-hmm.
What is MDR?
Manufacturing rejects.
Which you would have called Leo Lee. But I mean, that, and then you...
that was quality measurement, but
then you did MEO spares of 28 million.
Yeah, those military spares, right? Increases. I mean, you know, the pedigree of what I used to tell people when I interviewed for a plan. I said everywhere I've worked, after I've left, it's gotten better, and they'd all look at me like and start laughing. But the reality is, what you want is not to make a change. You want to make a change that, number one, is the right change that sustains itself, that keeps getting better and better and better. Not something that's a flash in the pan that makes you look good for a year, and then a year later, people aren't even doing it anymore. That was one of my things to some of the younger folks that I had that would come in and say, well, I've been on this job a year. I need to get this job for a year and then this job, and then I'm ready to be a manager, you know, or I'm ready to be, you know, an executive, or I'm ready for this. I said, well, first of all, let me tell you, you can do all that. You can leapfrog around, but what's your legacy? What are people going to talk about after you've gone? You know, what are people going to do? What have you implemented that really changed the business? Forget about fixing something. That's okay, but what did you do to make it better? What did you do to make it more profitable? What did you do to take cost out? What did you do to improve quality? There's a bazillion things that you can do you know, to have an impact, a positive impact that sustains itself.
I want to go back. I interrupted you, and I shouldn't have. I want to go back to the eggshell and how, within the context of either Lockheed Martin, General Electric, or whatever, you...
Let me give you a couple real quick. One of my jobs just before I went to Fort Wayne was this is really kind of got me going up the ladder. I'll say the escalator because it after this things really kind of took off for me. But in Lynn, which was a traditional management versus union environment, tough labor union, brutal labor union.
Which union was it? Which union was it?
IUE. International Electrical Workers. It's funny because in the plant that I worked in, we didn't do much electricity work, but that was the base union that was there. IUE.
Right.
Been there for a long time. Very strong. Very entrenched. Most of the people I dealt with, the union stewards and the like, their fathers worked. In some cases, their mothers and fathers worked. In some cases, their grandfathers had worked there. So it was a traditional, you know, industrial type of city that, you know, generation after generation. But anyway, I'm sitting there and I'm watching the assembly people do things, and that goes over to the test cell and it sits a while, and some instrumentation people come over and do some things, and then it gets set up in the test cell, and the testers run it. All these are different classifications, of course. I'm sitting there and I'm like, we're trying to compete here. And I said, this is ridiculous. I mean, this would be like playing basketball, except you can't dribble, pass, and shoot. You have to have a different person come in each time and switch with you. Okay, it's time to pass the ball. So, Joe, you come in and pass the ball. Okay, now it's time to shoot the ball. Bill, you come in and shoot the ball. I wasn't going to say rich, but anyway.
Even if you didn't need to, right?
You can understand that each one of these things is a handoff, okay? Each one of these things is an opportunity for somebody to come in and make a mistake. Each one of these things, it's tough to trace the ownership, okay? If you have a problem, if you have a success, well, why? What happened? And the more handoffs you have, the more time, the more cost, the more inefficiency you add in. So anyway, I decided, I said, you know what? We're going to combine these skills. Everybody says, oh, my God, you're out of your mind. You can't do that. We're going to combine functions.
Who told you that?
Just about everybody I talked to. Most of the salary people, the human resource people. But the one saving grace, and part of that is just you walk the shop, you know people by name, you try to know everyone, okay? There's some people that don't want to know you, okay? That's okay. But it's not for me from a lack of trying. It's not from the leader, you know, not trying to get people engaged. You try to get people engaged. You try to, rather than talk about what's going on with the newspaper, talk about what's going on with the job.
Well, there's a lot of people are threatened by something moving out of their comfort zone, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But that's not all bad. I mean, that's not all bad. And that's the bottom line. You got to, you know, so much history. Somebody, all you ever hear is all the bad things that people did. You never hear any of the good things. You always hear the bad things. Well, we tried that, you know, 10 years ago, and this is what happened. Or, yeah, we'll combine all this, and then we're all going to lose our jobs, you know, because you don't need as many of us. Well, anyway, like I say, it was about a two-year process, believe it or not, to get this thing going. But, again, I got the ground support. I had the strongest ally I had in this, believe it or not, were the labor unions. Was the union people.
No kidding.
Because they could understand, and part of that was the trust. They trusted me, but they could also understand that the way we're doing it now is inefficient. And when you try to compete and you're losing work, you know, it's like, what do you want to do? Do you just want to sit here and slowly die? Or do you want to, you know, do something, try it, and see if we can pull some things off? So, anyway,
we're
able to successfully do that.
You actually teamed up with the labor unions to increase efficiency, competitiveness, that led to job security.
That's correct.
And prosperity.
That's correct. I mean, because Lynn, which people had written off, you know, our area, probably 10 years ago, they had written it off, or 15 years ago. And now they're actually bringing in new work, and they're still there. So, and all the time I was there, the 5 years I was there, we did not have a layoff.
How would you? All right. I mean, there's so much here, Billy. I think that I've got to move on in this interview, but I want to come back to that in the last part because I think it's so important for this country.
Yep.
And you're keeping it a secret up there while you're retired. Okay, there you are, keeping it a secret, and I don't believe it should be kept a secret. Okay, because it's what I mean. It's like that union confrontation up in. Whatever that state was where he said enough's enough, the governor, okay?
Yep.
And let me ask you some more questions that I've got to keep going with this interview because we'll be here for a long time, and I've got to tell you, there's a lot more information that you need to disseminate that I believe you're obligated to disseminate at this point, okay? Because this country's in trouble, and we'll go to that. When someone joined your company, how did you orient them as a member of your team?
New employees?
Uh-huh.
Is that what you're asking?
Or new positions or whatever.
Well, one of the things we did, we set up we had a pretty detailed training program that, which is, you're going to probably laugh at this because it's kind of a foreign concept in this day and age, but I would take some of the hourly folks off the floor. And we'd have an interview process because we wanted people that, number one, could encapsulate their thoughts, could put them in writing, and also have some computer skills. But we would make
computer skills
training manuals.
In what era was this? What year was this?
This was back when I was started in Lynn, I did this basically. This was kind of part of my MO, I guess. I took the same concept in Indiana, and I had the same concept in Syracuse.
What year? What year in Lynn was this?
Would have been. Let me think a minute.
I mean, you're talking about
early 94-ish, maybe.
Okay. I'm sorry. You were. Go ahead.
No, it was earlier than that. It was around 1990.
Yeah, it was earlier than that.
Yep.
You're getting some timers and Alzheimer's, but I mean, you know, one of the key elements here is combining technology. This group wants us to combine technology with entrepreneurship, but so go ahead, continue on with your training thing.
There were a couple basic concepts that I did. First of all, to introduce the multi-skilling. That was something I totally believed in. So we got that going.
Whoa. What did you say? The multi what?
Multi-skilling is what I called it.
Multi-skilling. Never heard of that.
Yeah. Well, that was basically consolidate the workforce. So, I mean, think about it. Think about if you worked in a garage, okay, and someone, and you and I, well, let's just say, or any of your classmates, we basically start a garage, it's the two of us, and somebody brings the car in, so you have somebody who deals with whoever brings the car in. Then you have to diagnose what's wrong. You'd have somebody diagnosing what's wrong. Then you'd have to have somebody that takes the faulty part off. You have somebody else take the faulty part. In other words, every function you'd come across, you'd have some specialist that was doing that. Well,
that,
at the end of the day,
that relates to the handoffs, doesn't it?
You'd have nine different handoffs. You'd have nine different people doing nine different things. You know, the one person stops and where it's the next person's turn to step in, well, they're not there. They're on coffee break, or they're out today, or they're over here. And I'm like, God almighty, this is the most inefficient way of doing things. So we just blew away, and again, with a good training syllabus to back it up, which was fueled by the workforce, the people that actually did the work, participated along with a leader, a salaried leader, to organize their thoughts. Then we'd have a process where we went to the five people that did that function out in the workforce, and they would review the training package that hadn't been introduced yet, and make changes to it, or suggestions, or red pencil it, or blue pencil it, or whatever. And at the end of that process, which typically took probably about 2 to 3 weeks to do, you would have a training syllabus that was dead nuts. And the other positive thing that came out of that is now you got a guy that's, say, working second shift that nobody even knows, but you know what? He's got a way of doing this that's better than anybody else. He's come up with a way that he does this. It's faster and it's better quality, but nobody knows about it because he keeps this to himself because he's on, you know, second shift working at night when nobody's around. Well, now he participates in this thing, and he says, well, here's the way I do it, okay? Nobody's ever asked me for my opinion, but here's the way I do it. And, again, we review it, and lo and behold, it's probably saving 20% of your cost because he's got a way that does it that's a much higher quality way of doing it, and it's faster.
And now you've got the workers buying into this innovation because they're part of the interview process themselves.
Exactly.
And they are allowed to bring forth their ideas they've had for years that they had no hope of upper management implementing. You know, they went home, they made a living, and that was it. But then you generated them into innovators and have them buy in at the same time. Has this been ever done in GE?
It's probably never been done a lot of places because, I mean, you know, one of my roles in near the end of my my stay in Syracuse, we had done so well the first year, is that they wanted me to go around to different plants and make recommendations to the plants. Well, most of the places I went, my recommendation was to close the plant because it was like going back in the dark ages compared to some of the things I had seen. But it was funny because plants, and invariably they would take me in this mahogany-covered, beautiful conference room, and this guy, the president of the business, would have his entire staff there, and they would proceed to put up these organization charts with the intent of spending 3 hours on their organization chart and telling me how important and how each person would do what. I would get usually about 2 minutes into it and say, okay, I don't want to hear about the organization chart. I want to get on the floor. You know, who's in charge of this area? Who's in charge of that area? And these people would walk me down, and I'd say, well, they'd say, this is where we do this. I said, well, introduce me to this guy over here. He'd be working out in the shop. And the guy would walk over. These are, again, for the most part, government facilities, you know, working on government projects. So they'd all have ID badges.
Well, serious government projects, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
like,
and I mean, you know,
like what?
Clearance required projects anyway.
Weaponry.
And we'd walk up to the guy, and the manager that was taking me around would walk over and grab his badge, which was hanging on his shirt, and, oh, Joe, can you take, and I said, oh, this is interesting. And there was, I didn't know anybody in his own plant.
Right.
But,
wow.
That's why. You say, well, what can we do to turn things around? Well, I think that's one of the main reasons that people are, you know, you hear the stories of these executives that fly around on these corporate jets and they're out of touch with reality.
Well, that's primo.
A lot of truth to that.
How about General Motors completely ignoring, they must have flew from Detroit to the Bahamas, completely ignoring the 280Z coming in, which they could have crushed and emulated, and watching Toyota go from a 0.25% market share to 32% market share. What were they thinking?
Well, they weren't thinking, actually. They got lost
in the boardroom.
They got distracted. You know, they were going to do more than the auto industry. They were going to make airplanes, and they were going to make boats, and they were going to do this, and they were going to be a finance company. And the bottom line is they got away from their core strength. In the meantime, Toyota and some of these other countries, say Toyota, I look at Hyundai, I look at some of these cars when they first came over, that they were really just, you know, I mean, Hondas, they were, it was a motorcycle company, basically, but they were hungry, and they just took it away from them, you know, just absolutely took it away, great quality, and competitive price, and reliable, and in the meantime...
They were talking about built-in obsolescence was the key to profitability. How far would that have gone with Bill Bowser?
Not real far at all. I mean, the bottom line is, if you're designing something to fail and thinking you're going to make money on it, and your competitor is not only making a better quality product right out of the box, but he's, you know, 10 years later, they're still operating and operating fine, while the competitor, you know, you look at some of those General Motors cars from the late 80s, 2 years later, the paint's off. The paint is not even painted. It looks like it was almost like they put one coat of thin paint on it.
Well, let's work with the analogy.
Who's going to lose?
Let's work with that analogy, because I think you've brought up in me something. Here's the philosophy of built-in obsolescence so that we get them to rebuy versus the philosophy of built-in quality so we get them to rebuy on a longer cycle, but the initial buy cycle increases because of the longer cycle.
Absolutely, and it's not to say... You can't have an aftermarket. Absolutely, aftermarket is key. You know, aftermarket spare parts, especially in high usage area. Like for us, it was the military. You know, when we had Desert Storm, you know, you'd go over and you have a helicopter that's ingesting all that sand. Well, I don't know if you've ever seen any of the pictures, like from the Sahara, where they have these people that have these Mercedes or these fancy cars, and a sandstorm comes in overnight and sandblasts the paint off a car. I mean, obviously, you've got an aircraft that's running, and the way those parts are rotating at 18,000, 20,000 RPM, and you got the sand coming through, well, guess what? You're going to have to replace compressor blades and fan blades and the like.
It's very interesting you talk about that, because the school I'm going to, Western North Carolina University, was, I believe, key to the fixing of the their department, their technology department, was key to the fixing of the issue of sand and choppers.
Oh, I gotcha.
Which is rare. You know, I think at this point rare in academia, and hope, and you would hope more so.
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the keys to getting this thing turned around again, ultimately.
Well,
you get a lot of intelligent, people. You got, a desire to help, but there's no link that ties us all together right now.
No, there isn't, and some of the things in academia that I see going on in alternate energy and stuff like that, including GE, is the propensity to turn a project into an almost succeed, so that the grants, these $100 million grants, keep going, rather than having them succeed and come to a successful resolution and then moving on further.
Right.
And I see that with my interaction with some academia. It's demoralizing to this entrepreneur who was so hopeful that the people in academia really wanted to accomplish things and have some finality to their accomplishments, interacting with the private sector and then moving forward. And how much does it have as a result to the ramifications of us being the technological leader of the world, where it's like on a treadmill of mediocrity. But let me get off the soapbox here, because it's you that's supposed to be on it, and not me. But you made me upset. Okay.
Yeah. Well, the bottom line is, what we tried to do is number one, get ownership, drive it to every level. Ownership. Whatever you're doing, everybody that's working on that thing has to feel like they own it, and they're part of it. And the way you do that, part of that goes back to that knowledge. If you have knowledge, share it. Everybody needs to know, what's going on. You can't have people, and there's another personality, I've got this little piece of information, so it makes me important. If I give it to you, I'm less important. Okay, there's people with that kind of a mindset. And I don't care. It's not just about work. It's about anything. In my attitude, you have people like that. Do not ever even attempt to have them in any kind of position of power or supervision or leadership, because they're a cancer. Okay, they'll actually hurt. They'll actually hurt you by doing nothing. Okay, and
making sure that other people do nothing.
Right. Well, and that's the end result of it.
But you stopped that.
What?
You stopped that in each plant.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, because people like that.
And how did you do that?
When you see them, you find them, you got to get them out of there. You got to get them out of those roles. You got to basically demote them, okay? And my point is, why I emphasize the word demote, you can't just put them in a position where they're essentially, still, I'm still getting the same amount of pay, I'm still in control, I'm still in power. You don't want that. You want to show an example to people. It's like when you do the wrong thing. See, so many times what I see, and maybe this is from a sports thing also, or from us growing up, but so many times you walk in, you see something that's wrong, okay? Now, the tentative leader or the weak leader, what he'll do, he'll have a meeting, and not with the one or two people that have the bad behavior. He'll have everybody. He'll say, no, we need to stop doing this. We need to stop doing that. Why? Because they're afraid to confront the individual on the spot and chastise them for what they're doing wrong and make sure you never do it again, okay? But no, they don't do that. They have a group meeting where it takes time, you tie everybody up, and everybody has to listen to the threats, about how this is bad, what you're going to do. And 9 times out of 10, 90% of those people will tell you, why don't you just address the problem? Why do you waste our time? We're not doing anything wrong. These three people are doing something wrong. Why don't you fix that, okay? And that was one of the things, I guess, just growing up in the environment that we were in. It wasn't like, it took a lot of time for us to figure that out. If you saw something was wrong, you went right after it and you fixed it.
Well, is it so really what you did was create, within a plant setting, hundreds of entrepreneurs who felt not only who felt obligated and enjoyed their own creations and contributing those creations to a better productivity, and you gave them ownership. And how did you motivate and reward these people?
You know, it's funny because this is the other thing that's such a misconception. People think that you give, $500 bonuses out to people that do something really good. Well, the problem with that is what I found is, number one, when you give something like that kind of dollar magnitude out, usually you get it wrong anyway, because usually you'll give it to somebody and it turns out it was three people, not one person. It was just one person took credit for it. Or, in many cases, you want to reward because somebody did something really good. Well, they might have done something good for 2 or 3 days, and the rest of the year they've kind of slouched off because they knew that this had a lot of visibility to it. That's another type of person, the person that wants to be the spotlight, the hero. What we would do basic, simple stuff. We would sometimes we'd have like a Boston Celtics night, we'd go in and get tickets basically for the whole group, okay? Or we'd have a pizza party, spur of the moment pizza party. All three shifts, I'd come in at, sometimes it'd be 3 o'clock in the morning because that was the lunch break for the third shift. But I'd make sure that every time we had something like that, I'd be there and basically give them a little 5-minute spiel about thank you. This was awesome, and then everybody got to partake in it. So it kind of built like not a one-person thing or a two-person thing, but it built an entire team. It built a whole camaraderie of people and being appreciative. I tried birthday meetings where anybody had a birthday in a certain month. I'd have a one-hour meeting on all three shifts so people could communicate, tell me if they had any questions or what they liked or what they didn't like. But just simple, honest to God, just simple stuff. Not stuff that was going to rack up a lot of money. I mean, if somebody really, truly came up with some creative thing that was going to change the business, absolutely, we would have, a significant dollar reward for them. But that was the exception rather than the rule. When we had rewards, we like to have parties for everybody.
It wasn't about the money. It was about the recognition of achievement.
Absolutely. And sometimes I'd just walk up and shake hands with somebody. Like I'd come in on a Monday, and somebody had done something on a Saturday or a Sunday. And most Saturdays I was in there. Some Sundays I was in there, but I would just walk up to the person, maybe in his peer group, maybe in the break area, and just go up and shake hands with him and just say, hey, Judy or Fred or whatever, thank you. You really made a huge difference for us. I appreciate everything you did. And you did the good work.
You created a new culture of appreciation,
yep.
Teamwork, innovation, okay?
Does it sound familiar to you?
Yeah, the question I ask you, yeah, that's right. I mean, I remember coming back from college or something, and you had a baseball game. I hadn't played baseball in years, and I got up, and since I didn't have timing, I hit it down the right field line. Do you remember that?
Yep.
And got this fat body that was overweight from eating too much food for a triple. And slid front forward. I mean, you expected that of me, okay? I didn't, and then stole home, I think, or something.
You had me up until that stealing home thing. You know, I can remember.
Yeah, but I added that. I'm sorry. I have poetic license. I'm the interviewer. I don't know how I got home, but I know I slid in first. I had first.
I think you slid home on a home run, but.
There's the mighty bear being the mighty. They probably won't.
The other issue is part of this too is your responsibility. I mean, you got to relentlessly, you know, pursue more work because as you get good and you get more efficient, absolutely you need less people. Okay, but the key is for you to hold up your end of the bargain because you've asked these people to improve. You have to improve, and that was actually one of my huge knocks, especially on the salaried workforce. When I first went to Syracuse, which is one of the positions on there, that was Lockheed Martin. That was a vice president role. Well, Syracuse was a radar and sensor group, okay? It was kind of a twofold. We had the radar division, which was one huge building, beautiful, beautiful. It was like a college campus. I mean, it was huge. At one time, it was 19 buildings. They had gone through some tough times. They were now down to like 3 buildings, okay? But it looked like an Ivy League campus. All the bricks were like a cream, yellowish kind of cream color. I mean, it was beautiful. The trees, everything. I mean, I'd walk through there. I said, my God, this is the most beautiful place I've ever worked. But they had no work. And for every hourly person, it was a salary person, basically. It was like a one-to-one relationship. I'm like, how can this be? I mean, how can this be? I mean, you talk about checkers. You talk about inefficiency. You talk about overhead. And they couldn't figure out why they weren't winning any new business. Well, because their costs were so high. They were carrying so many people. And I go into the president. I was in vice president role there. I went into the president after I was there about 3 months, and I said to him, I said, first of all, after you're in a job for a month, you got to capture all your ideas. I mean, basically the first week or two, you probably know 80% of what you need to know about your workforce, about your work and the way it flows. And I knew nothing about radar. Okay, I don't even pretend that I knew anything about radar. I didn't know very much about sonar either. But that doesn't matter.
You knew about radar in a football game.
Exactly.
Pal.
You know about people. You know about, you know, seeing parts. You know, I had a guy come in from Japan one time when I was working at Hooksett, and he talked about inventory and parts flow. And he said, you know, Bill, he says, this is actually... one of the better plants, I had been there about a year and a half when he came in. He was a lean manufacturing guy, they would get people, because it was kind of the Toyota method. I don't know if any of your audience is familiar with lean manufacturing, but...
I don't know that they are, you know.
But anyway, it's a tempo. It's basically parts are continually moving through the shop. The best example... They give Toyota all the credit for this, by the way.
Well, since I've been in the food business with a shelf life problem, obviously moving inventory is crucial, okay?
Absolutely, and having less inventory. The less, the better. I mean, theoretically, you ought to have enough inventory to do everything that you're going to ship today, okay? And then basically overnight... Train comes in, drops off the next inventory for what you're going to do the next day. That's the Michael Dell method.
Well, that's called just-in-time delivery, right?
He actually gets paid for the computer that he mails you. He gets paid for that before he has to pay his suppliers.
Oh, yeah. The relationship.
That's the absolute best business model you could have, okay?
The relationship of that to cash flow is unbelievable.
Yep. But they, anyway, they, I was starting to say that we had this example, and everybody was talking about the Toyota method. Well, what's funny about it, if you ever read back on Henry Ford basically came up with this concept, and this is the way. I mean, Henry Ford was a brilliant guy. He was also a nut. Okay, he was also, you know, somebody that had a lot of social issues and other problems, but...
I can relate to that.
From a manufacturing standpoint, the guy was absolutely brilliant. He was so far ahead of his time, it's mind-boggling. Because even today, when you looked at General Motors in the like early 2000s, late 90s, they still had not adapted some of the things that he did in 1900, okay, which is what Toyota basically came in and copied and perfected, okay, to their credit. But it was about having parts move. Well, anyway, this Japanese guy comes in, and he says to me, he goes, "Well," he says, "you've done a good job here." He says, "I was here 2 years ago. This is definitely much improved." But he says, "Most of your parts are asleep, you know." And I thought that was such an interesting comment to make. And what he meant by that, if you walk through an area that's building things, and you come back a day later, and 70% of those parts that are on the shelves are still in the exact same position, what are you doing? Okay? I mean, what actually are you doing? And that, in the meantime, that's cost of goods, it's money, it's cash flow.
It's interest. So, it's interest, okay?
It's everything.
Yeah.
It's everything. And so that was one of the things that we really picked up on.
Dead inventory.
Yeah, and we did in Indiana and then again in Syracuse. And both of those plants, when I left, within a year, were selected by Industry Week as top 10 plants in America.
So, oh, my. I was going to ask you what happened in Syracuse. I was so... Here's a plant that's not making money and is beautiful on the outside and sick on the inside.
I'll tell you real quickly. I went into the president and I started to...
Wait a minute. Let's stay there. It was voted. Here's that plant that came from non-function, really, basically. And then in how many years were you there? And then it became in the top 10 manufacturing.
Was there 2 years? And then the guy that followed me was there. At the end of the first year, they basically were selected for top 10.
That's a
similar story in Fort Wayne. I was there for a little over 3.5 years. And the end of, I believe it was the end of the first year or two-thirds of the way through the first year, the guy that took over, who actually was a good friend of mine, he worked for me when I was there. He was in the commercial repair business. And similar MO, I mean, same type of things. We did multi-skilling. We did quality. We built a training syllabus for the entire workforce. And again, took a tremendous amount of cost out and implemented the lean manufacturing. And it works. I mean, you reinvest in some technology, but...
Well, one of the keys...
The Syracuse thing, I just want to finish this thought, because what happened there, when I was there for about 3 months, I realized, I said, God, there's so many people basically doing the same things. It's redundant here. And I said, we can't win work. They haven't won any new work for 3 years. This is a death sentence. I said, this is, I actually questioned a few times why I even went there, because I was never into the stat. I mean, it was the vice president's job. Somebody would say, well, that's the reason you took it, because it was your ego and it was a big title. But that really wasn't the prime driver for me. It was the fact of, I guess I was getting back to the East Coast. I was moving from Indiana to New York, and then eventually I wanted to be back in Massachusetts.
Your comfort zone.
Well, it's just, I've been all over. I went to school in Arizona. Mm-hmm. I've been in California. I spent time in the Midwest, or as I call it, the Middle East.
Well, let's stick with
east of the Mississippi, right? But
can we make an analogy? Can we make an analogy between the transition of Syracuse, where America has gone in the last 10 years from 20% manufacturing down to 9%?
Absolutely, you can. Absolutely. That's a...
Please make that analogy. And, I'm going to skip some of these questions because, how do you keep up with best practices in the industry? And, how are things going in your company in general? I'm going to skip these questions because the content of what you're saying is so crucial.
We've covered it anyway.
How do you describe a typical day? You already did that. Instead of 9 to 5, it was 5 to 9 like a farmer. You know, how did you first enter work? What advice would you give somebody who's considering a career? You know, all that stuff. What kind of formal education and additional?
I do want to address that one though somewhere, and I'll do it quickly. But as far as the Syracuse and the analogy, I went into the president. I said, "We got to have a layoff," and he goes, "Well, we haven't had a layoff here in 5 years, and it was a big one." And I said, "Well, apparently it wasn't big enough because I've got too many people here." And I said, quite frankly, too many salary people. That was the real shock. They said, "Oh, you're going to go to the workforce. We're going to have to deal with the union." I said, "No, not in this situation." I said, "I've got for every guy working on the shop floor, I've got somebody else washing them." And I said, "The first thing you got to do is you got to eliminate the checkers and the supervisors and people like that. I mean, if you want one salary person or two salary persons, you know, per shift that are there for other things, you know, like technical support or whatever, that's one thing. But just have people that are assigned there watching these people." I said, number one, they don't feel any ownership. They're not responsible for anything because they can always say, "Well, so-and-so, he's the one that's, you know, watching me or looking over me." So anyway, we had a pretty good sized layoff. And I remember I was...
Responsibility and accountability, where every entrepreneur...
Absolutely.
Entrepreneurs know that their backs are against the wall. It seems that you entered the entrepreneurial spirit, which is do or die.
Well, you want to win. You want to win.
Right.
You want to win. And if winning is getting more work and being successful and being more profitable, and you can't get no more work because you're too expensive, you're too top heavy, you're too your overhead rates are way too high, then you got to do something about it. Well, anyway, it was funny because we had this discussion, and this guy liked me. I mean, he basically liked me, I think, because he knew I was, you know, into sports, and I was, I worked hard, you know, and I was an honest guy. And, it was interesting, but at the end he says, I just hope you know what you're doing. You know? I said, well, listen, I said, I guess we already know that because otherwise you wouldn't have hired me if I didn't know what I was doing. And I said, my track record, I said, I'm not going to go on and on here. I said, you can call whoever you want to call, but I assume you've already done that because you already gave me the job. But I said, I've been here 3 months and I got to tell you something. I can't win in the environment that we're in right now. We can't win. And so you proved the thing. It was a little bit emotional because we were the only area that was doing anything. And then about a year later, I ended up coming back in his office right around the same time, and I said, we got to kind of do the same thing again. And he says, "Well, geez, why didn't we do it the first time?" I said, "No, couldn't do it the first time because it was such a sticker shock here. Nobody had done it." And I said, "Now that we've, by losing some people, it drove us to do things differently. And you're getting some positive results, and the financial numbers were much better." And so he said, "Oh, okay." And he was supportive this time. I said supportive in the fact that he didn't ask me if I knew what I was doing. Like I say, now, it's probably 7 years, 15 years later. The first 6 or 7 years after I left, they actually were bringing new work in. And they had gone and had the opportunity to hire some people. So it's a positive.
And so here we are, okay. It's related to the last question, okay?
Yep.
So I'm not going to go there. Here we are thinking that we can't manufacture in America, and here you are proving that we can and building a foundation in a plant that that just keeps on ticking after you leave it. You know, most of the companies that I've been involved with after I sell them go downhill. But the companies that I have built correctly, most of my food products are still on the shelf unless the company went out of business for some criminal reason.
You and I have had this discussion though. I think there's different types of leaders, and I think, my take on you, okay, for what it's worth, okay.
That was the name of my column. You just crossed a trademark.
Great idea, guy. you know, fantastic idea guy, endless ideas, which is awesome, because some people never have a good idea in their life. I shouldn't say that. They do, but they don't have the balls to do anything with it. But you always had that innate ability to come up with creative things, okay? And that's wonderful. When you combine that with somebody who's what I'll call the execution type person, and not executing by killing people and lowering your workforce, but by being able to perform and set up an environment where things not only get done, but people have a good time doing it. That's what we've kind of lost here. I think there's such a distrust between labor and management in most places, and probably for good reasons. You know, people always say, well, gee, the only place you ever worked that was non-union was Hooksett. And I said, yeah, I said it was really good. But I said, to me, a lot of the places I worked that were union shops were just as good. Okay, the difference is, the reason there's labor unions to begin with, I firmly believe.
Can I stop you there? I've been looking for the answer for years, where without unions, the Rockefellers and the whatevers of the world, and the sweatshops and the whatever, without and the coal mines, without unions, there would be no dignity. Right. And yet now, they've lost their way.
It's gone the other way, right?
They've lost their way, but you actually have found a formula to work with them, but it's a secret.
You know,
Billy, I gotta be honest with you. At this point in the interview, I gotta tell you, I don't think you're doing your job.
Yeah.
I know it's not your personality. You know, me, I go on TV and in articles and whatever. It's not your personality to do so, but don't you think you owe America this formula? Because we certainly don't know it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm going to challenge you to share it.
You can challenge me all you want, because you pick the ones you want to go after and you have fun with it, you know?
Well, you know what? If you don't explore it, if you don't explain it, you're clear that I will, won't you?
Yeah. You mentioned about young folks just starting off and advice and whatever, but one of the things that was really neat about this whole process is that I had some great people that I mentored in each area that I worked, some of which ended up running businesses, becoming vice presidents, being extremely successful, you know, to carry the torch. A lot of them will call me from time to time, or I'll bump into them from time to time, and it's a blast. And so you talk about that's my reunion, because good people, it's contagious. You get around good people, and you can't have enough. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, people say, well, gee, you're so lucky because
You know what, Billy? I don't think you're giving yourself enough credit. Good people without being mentored by good people don't necessarily end up as good people. They end up in the settle for thing. And I think that's one of the things that America has gotten into, is the settle for and the retreat to entitlements and et cetera.
I agree.
Do you have any advice as to formal education and additional specialized training think is good for a person entering into a profession like yours?
Yeah, education-wise, that's fine. Okay, I mean, I think you continue to learn all through your life. I mean, the smartest person, I say today, I'll say to again, the smartest person I ever met was my dad. Okay, never went to college.
It wasn't me.
Okay? No. You were somewhere on the list. Oh, I'll give you credit for that. I will say we're at a higher low, but anyway, education is great.
I think this interview's over. Go ahead. Sorry. Go back to education.
Yeah, I'm almost done here. But no, all kidding aside, I think the key is to find something that you enjoy doing, okay, and just go 110, you know, and surround yourself, look at people that jump out at you as being knowledgeable, and glean whatever you can from them. I mean, one of the things early on for me was with GE, there were a couple guys that were in the engineering department that I absolutely became friends with. I mean, to the point of, hey, you know, buying them a lunch from time to time just to pick their brain, just to talk to them a little bit.
Well, what are we going to say here at this point in the interview is ask you for five attributes, characteristics of entrepreneurship or entrepreneurship that made you, and behaviors and abilities that made you successfully. Pick five. I'm going to read some off after you pick these five. I think you've...
All right, well, let me think about it for a minute. I mean, there's a couple that just absolutely jump right out. Self-confident.
Mm-hmm.
Passionate. I think inquisitive. Obviously,
you've already said driven.
Driven. Creative. There's more than it. Again, I could probably go on and on and on.
Well, have at it, because
actually, one of the ones that I got to tell you is, which is funny because it sounds so simple, but you got to be a good judge of people. Okay, and most people aren't. Okay.
That's certainly not necessarily my strength.
Yeah, well, I think that...
You know, I would interview somebody, I would interview somebody and see them for what they could be rather than what they are.
Right, exactly. And I'm the same way. I think the other key is, it's not knowing what you know, it's knowing what you don't know. In other words, have a good grasp of what you're not good at and make damn well sure that you've got part of your team or part of your staff or whatever level you're at, make sure that you've got people, you surround yourself with people that have that skill. In other words, what you don't want is, you know, I think of the bobblehead dolls. You don't want five bobblehead dolls around you that are all nodding yes all the time. You want people that will challenge you. You want people that have the guts to say, wait a minute, stop. You know, you're wrong, okay? Or at least to the point where you can have some creative conflict, okay, and be
define. I love that.
Open to opposing ideas.
Define creative conflict. I love that.
In other words, have some heated debates. You know, have some heated debates. Have arguments. But at the end of, you know, whatever it is, at the end of that period, whether it be minutes or an hour or whatever, basically come out of that room or wherever you are as one unified group. You know, this is the way we're going. That was a spirited debate. And if nothing else, even if you don't change your mind, acknowledge the fact that, you know what, you made me look at this thing differently to think about something a little bit differently that I wasn't looking at. And then if you're really special, have the balls to change the way you're going. You know, have the chutzpah, the rocks to basically, Jesus, this is something I didn't look at.
Let's go there for a second.
Right.
Let's go there for a second, okay?
Yeah.
I didn't ask you about the most succinct failure you had and what you learned from it. Pick.
That was interesting because every time I, near the end especially, I'd get interviewed because some of these jobs were, you know, pretty good sized jobs. When I was in the Hookset job, I had 1,000 people working for me. And
that's because they didn't know you.
Exactly. That's my clothes. But anyway, they would have a different team, sometimes different teams of the workforce that would interview me. You know, you'd go through like a sequence of maybe 9 or 10 interviews over the course of the day. Not just the high level people, but some of the folks at the shop floor. And one of the questions, have you ever made a mistake? You know? Are you kidding me? Show me somebody that doesn't make a lot of mistakes. I'll show you people that don't do anything different. You know? I made a lot of mistakes. I think the biggest mistakes though that I learned from.
Pick one. pick the worst one, the most painful.
Well, I think the worst one for me was my first job when I started off in the assembly area. There were like five or six of us. We were all young guys. It was my second assignment. I think I told you that I was like a kid in the candy store. And we're building these engines. And it took probably, they were all development parts. They were all new concepts and everything. So it took the good part of probably 2 months to get this thing finally built. And then it goes over to a test cell. It's really an engine that was the equivalent of just putting up in a fighter plane, a single engine fighter plane. So you'd take it over to the test cell, you'd start it, it'd go through like a break-in period, you know, where you'd kind of go up a little bit, come back down, and kind of saw cut your way up until you had been up to max power. And then you had to run like a 150-hour strenuous endurance test on it, and then tear it down after you were done. That would take about 3 weeks. And then you'd bring it back to assembly and tear it down, and that would take somewhere upwards around 4 or 5 days because you had to document everything. So anyway, it was very competitive because we all had our own engines. All these guys are starting off just like I am. This is my, I had worked over there for 2 weeks and I get an engine. And one of the first things you do, you have a frame, it's called a front frame, and the compressor sits down in the front frame, gets bolted in, some bearings go on, seals, and then the combustion frame goes on top of that, and then they turn it, and they finally build the whole engine. But that's the core of the engine right there. Well, it gets over the test cell, and after, I think it was 3 minutes, all of a sudden all these red lights are flashing. And turns out that it had a bad oil leak, and it was down in the front frame area, which meant it couldn't be fixed in the test cell. Very disappointing. Because, like I say, the mission of the thing was to run 150 hours, get a lot of information on the parts and everything. So we bring it back to assembly, and what had happened, the assembler, when he was putting it together, he put the carbon seal in.
I was going to say he forgot to put the seal in.
Yeah, well, he put the seal in, but he didn't put the ring to hold it in place. And it cracked into 1,000 pieces, a little carbon piece. And oil flooded flooded everything. It was a disaster. I mean, we didn't fail anything, but it set the program back about 3 months by the time we got everything turned around. And of course that was my claim to fame whenever they heard my name. Oh yeah, he had good old engine 7 or whatever, you know. So, well, what I learned from that was I was spending so much of my time on the theoretical part, you know, the paperwork part, as opposed to just being out there and looking at the hardware, you know, and if you think about it, the first time if something's going together, that's a perfect opportunity, and that's the reason why that assignment is so critical, because not only you look at it, blueprints and the theoretical part of it, but here you get the opportunity to actually see, which was the exciting part, actually, you know, because you actually can see these different concepts and how they respond. So what I learned from that was, get out, get around, don't just focus on one or two things that you think are important at the expense of, you know, not talking to some of the basic people. And I never had anything really like that again.
Getting your hands completely dirty through the process.
Exactly.
Tell me about your biggest, I mean, to me, that's not a failure at all. But people would like to jump on you for it, and they were jumping on the wrong boy, because you know, you jump on Billy and he's going to jump back at you.
I think that probably the multi-skilling,
the success
earlier when we went through the negotiations, because I was so close to the workforce, you know, I could talk to people and bounce ideas back and forth, and then the union relations people got wind of this, and so I got called to this meeting along with a guy that I had working for me, that he ended up leaving the company right after the meeting. He was so disgusted with the way this meeting went. And
well, this is the guy working for you?
I'm a multimillionaire, basically, Kevin Colcord. He went around and worked with Ford and General Motors and all these different plants all over the country, including a couple oil companies, teaching lean manufacturing. But anyway, we get invited to this meeting, and the guy starts off with, now he says, you realize how much progress we've made in Lean? It was all about image. You know, it was all about this image that supposedly Lynn had with corporate offices, that they were such a progressive plant, and how everything was in such great shape from a union relations standpoint, which was a pretty arguable point to begin with, because it was, you know, it was actually a ridiculous point. But I listened to all of it. And he said, now you've put all of this in jeopardy because you've directly with the union. And I said, well, the union's fine. I said, I haven't seen it. He says, now you don't tell me how the union is. I'm the union expert here. I said, okay, fine. Go ahead. Go through your spiel. And I said, so anyway, it was almost like playing the umpires a little bit for a call, because I let him finish. And I said, well, I said, I can see this is a witch hunt. And I said, quite frankly, the only message I'm going to walk away from here is that you guys aren't going to support my multi-skilling initiative, or our multi-skilling initiative. And he said, well, what makes you think that? And I said, well, you don't want to see this thing pass, because you know that we've initiated it and you didn't initiate it. And it's obviously going to be a black eye. And I said, I can't imagine how hard, because I did need these guys to, you know, set up the meetings with the union officials and actually get the vote going and everything else to make this thing pass. And anyway, we're walking back from that meeting. It was basically, I guess for lack of a better term, an ass-chewing for both of us. And my cohort, Kevin, said, this place is doomed. He says, this is similar to your other question about manufacturing in America, you know, and he says, this is the typical response, you know, from upper management as far as making changes or anything. It's just archaic.
Did you ever read Atlas Shrugged, Billy?
No, I have not. But
it's a good idea in your spare time, but...
Yeah. But anyway, it's... It was funny because the guy could tell, there were two people, the union relations guy and the HR guy. The HR guy, Steve Thorne, really a good guy, but he was between a rock and a hard place. But he called me on the phone, and I said, well, Steve, I said, he says, how do you feel? And I said, well, I said, I'll be honest with you. I said, aggravated, I guess would be the term I would use. Trying to do the right thing, trying to make the changes here that are going to make this place successful, and I feel like it's one thing to be able to negotiate with the union, but when I have to really negotiate with my own salaried group here and with some of the leadership of the plant, I feel like it's a steep slope uphill. But I said, if you guys think you're going to break me of this, I said, all you've done is just fire me up more. And I said, I just realized the fact that I'm not going to get any help. He goes, oh, no, you'll get help. I said, yeah. I said, the guy helping me is the guy that just spent an hour telling me all the things I was doing wrong. I said, how much do you think he's going to help me? I said, I could see him holding this up as an example anyway. Make a long story short, he must have called the guy, because the guy all of a sudden starts calling me and says, come on over, we're going to have meetings on how to proceed with this. And We ended up getting the thing passed. It passed by 3 votes out of, I think it was like 2,000 people.
Wow.
That's how close it was. But
wow.
It was, to this day, first and still is the only agreement that's been made with the union to combine rates like that.
Multi-skilling. And, you know, one of the entrepreneurial traits that is taught in one of our books that, is how to wear multiple hats. And of course, you know, I had to both in the underground irrigation business dig the trenches. Okay, I was good at that. And I was good at sales. And then I had a partner who was good at tactical. Okay? And you and me, on the field of glory, had augmentative skills. I think it's a really important... this list, I don't need to go over this list of entrepreneurial tools, characteristics, and abilities. You've added some things to this list, okay? Of course, I won't give you credit for it because you never bought me a pizza, okay, for my contribution.
Your memory is starting to fail you. I think every time we went out to eat, I bought, but no problem.
Well, that was about learning how to manage cash flow.
That was ice cream.
Brigham's ice cream. That's correct.
The memory's coming back.
Yeah, it is coming back, and I'm not sure that I'd want to go there. But
well,
I mean,
good luck with this because our 1 hour interview is going on for 2.5 hours.
That's right. The professors are going to say, and the other people they call them cohorts are going to, they're going to be gone in an hour. But why can't this thing turn into a paper? Because it's worth it, and it's worth it for America. I mean, I don't want to admit this because you and I have been competitive all our lives and also been partners as well. You know, I made you some money in the real estate business and you were always there for me, when things weren't going so well. And, but I think, crucially for the country, using your, entrepreneurial skill sets, how will we survive the current economic climate? You've already talked about solutions that you did on a microcosmic level. I mean, they weren't so micro, okay? Do you have any solutions?
I would love to just be able, obviously it's not going to happen, but I would love to be able to go in 4 months or 6 months, take a team of people and just basically, don't even need to know my name. Just like, give me the wherewithal to fix some of this stuff. That's crazy. I think the first thing, which reminds me kind of a microcosm with Syracuse, but number one, the government has gotten way, way, way too big. And I think the first thing you got to do, everybody's got their staffs and their support staffs and the like. I would just like to count off by twos. And, I think the second thing would be to take away all these special, benefits, the retirement benefits, the medical benefits. But everybody, everybody has a situation that once they're out of the government, they're treated just like all the other citizens are, you know, have your own, situation. But right now, I think the number one thing is to just get to the point where you've got fiscal accountability. I mean, the fact that we're spending more money, than we're taking in, how can you can't run a household like that, let alone a government. And, I think part of that is you gotta get, the government's gotta be significantly smaller and get back to the basics.
I think you're
being dependent on some of these foreign countries like China as much as we are and start taking control of our own destiny again.
I mean, basically what you're saying, I think, is that we should be running this country like a sick Syracuse
fix it
dynamically like you fixed it, okay?
Yep.
And I think you're also saying, which I haven't heard, is that too much of, is that do you believe that this country, see, I do, because of the, but currently not in this environment, because the environment is not conducive to entrepreneurial startups, which is
too many regulations.
The Henry Ford, Steve Jobs, Richard Morris of the world,
yep.
not just government regulation, but funding. I mean, there's no relationship banking anymore, okay?
Oh, I agree. I've got no,
I can create jobs, always have, you know that, Billy. But the money goes to Solyndra instead of Greenworth, Greenfields, okay?
I agree.
And who's picking these people? Bureaucrats and people who have not been on the shop floor, okay?
I agree.
And, do you feel, I believe you do, but correct me if I'm wrong, do you feel that this country can go from 9% back to 20, 25% manufacturing in a different environment?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. There's no question about it. People are hungry. People want to work. People have good ideas. The problem now, what we do, is not only we get the manufacturing overseas, but the part that people just do not understand is all that technical intelligence, all that information is lost. Because once it goes over there, a short time later, all these things are copied. I don't care what it is, and you lose those ideas. You lose that leadership. That's the strength of this country, is you've got people that are creative, that want to win, and you're taking that whole competitive spirit away. You know, the way this is set up right now, there's way too many regulations, there's way too much red tape, and there's, the other focus is, it's not about fixing the country, it's about getting reelected.
Oh.
And that's the sad part. And I'm not just talking about Obama, I'm talking about at every level. I mean, it's just, it is sad, it's pathetic, you know?
Keep going, buddy.
Yeah.
Keep going. I mean, you're hitting on the points. I mean, I hate to say it, you know. I mean, and it's not just Obama.
I'll go back to the leadership thing. You know, I've seen things. You know, and quite frankly, it's not the political party that bothers me as much as the people on both sides are so polarized right now. I mean, it's the worst I've ever seen it. I wasn't here for the Great Depression. But I don't think that, you know, the Great Depression is anything, you know, that's significantly worse than what we're in right now.
Mort Zuckerman.
I think it's a different type of...
You know, I was in the real estate business. You know, I was in the real estate business during this, and Mort Zuckerman, who's actually bigger than Trump,
yep,
said that in terms of real estate, this is worse than the Great Depression.
I definitely believe it.
And when you've got, unfortunately speaking, 27% of the GMP being related to construction and real estate, whether it be that antique shop who can't sell anything because nobody's moving around, and then you get Dechner who says, here's the Real Estate Stabilization Act, which nobody bought, 12% of it was spent because it was so pathetic, okay? When what brought you to this position, real estate with people making money by not doing anything but packaging it, okay, and with the metaphysic of entitlement to derive from the Clintons on up and everything, that everybody should own a home whether they can afford it or not, and then the foundation of value for banks, which was making money off the interest of a valid loan, okay, collapses, and to do nothing,
yeah,
about 27% of the GMP, which then spreads. The fact is that 28% of homeowners are behind in their payments, and there's probably 10 to 20%, I understand, of renters who are behind in their payments. So therefore, these 9% unemployment numbers, even the Unemployment Insurance Commission does not, when I talk to them, they know that's not true. You're talking about approximately 38 to 40% of this country is in trouble.
Yeah, I agree.
And
the other piece of this, too, which you can't overlook, are these wars that we're in. It's like, end the wars. However, which way you have to end them, but end them. You can't afford to be in these wars, period, okay? You can't afford to be spending the kind of outlays that you pay. I mean, it's one thing if you're the richest country in the world and your balance sheet says you're the richest country in the world. See, people have the impression that we're the richest country in the world. We aren't anymore.
No.
We aren't even close. I mean, we might not even be in the top 20, but people don't want to talk about that. You know, it's like this huge ego thing almost, you know. Oh, we're America. We're this, we're that. Well, you know what? Go back to the basics and let's be America again. But we're certainly not there right now. I mean, you have these politicians talking about how they're going to fix the budget. They're going to balance the budget. 89% of 95% of the balancing of the budget is after they're out of office. What is that all about? You know? So my take is, if it's going to be done when you're out of office, get out of office now then, and let some new people come in with better ideas, and obviously more of an incentive and drive to do this.
Well, your history has said
about politics.
No, that's okay, because it's a very important thing to entrepreneurs like me and new budding. I mean, these kids are sitting in front of me while I'm lecturing at Western for this class, and I said, I got to tell you, it's a good thing you're a freshman, okay? Because right now, if you want to start your own business, man, I'm even as creative as I am. Unless you're talking about family and friends, and I know what a tightwad you are with your millions of dollars. I had to stick that in there. Okay. But when you're there, when I need you, you're there. For me as a best friend, I mean, you know, you've made millions of dollars and kept it. Okay.
Yeah.
And, damn it, you deserve it for sure. Cause you've made hundreds of.
My only take is, I want to see other people be successful. Like I said to you early on in this thing, you want to be at the finish line, you want to win, but when you're on a team, you want your teammates there right with you, okay? And that's kind of how I feel, as corny as it sounds. I want people to be successful. I mean, success breeds success. It's a great environment. Anybody that's ever won a championship or a spelling bee, anything where you've won, it's such a rise. It's such a great ride. You feel awesome. It pumps you up. And you know what? You want to do more. Winning breeds winning. And right now, like I say, unfortunately, in this country, I don't feel like, not only we're not winning, I don't even feel like we're in the game right now. And we're giving it away, so.
That's quite the opposite concept of income redistribution, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
It is.
It's
more like the Cub Scouts, you know. I mean, hey, we've got 12 cookies, everybody gets a cookie, okay? And the bottom line is, you know.
Were you in the Girl Scouts, Billy?
Huh?
You were in the Girl Scouts?
I think I said Cub Scouts, but that's okay.
Cub Scouts didn't deal with cookies, Billy. I think this is a serious issue now.
See you later.
No. We've got to end this thing. I just want to say that you see how Bill, this is how Bill left conversations as a kid. If it wasn't going his...
Here will be the receiver.
If it wasn't going his way or the way he went, and that's part of his business personality too, and goes back to the time when he told that story about how they weren't going to support his multi-skilling, and generated fear in management, who really did know that he was right, but
absolutely,
and didn't, and had one of the.
I will give you some props for that one, some ups.
Well, I mean, there's two major motivations sometimes in the thing. One is fear of loss and greed. They had the fear of loss of you, and they knew somehow that if they lost you, that ultimately they would lose their own.
It's like I said to you earlier, and I mean, you and I, we both went by this, but, you know, you may beat me. Okay, but that's the battle. That's not the war. Okay, and the bottom line is, if I believe in something strong enough, believe me, I'm going to see it through, and I'm going to go back and say, you know what, I screwed up there. Now I got to go back and I got to kind of recalculate. How am I going to get this through? And I come back the next day with a different approach, but basically the same concept. I'm not going to sell myself short. If I know it's the right thing to do, you're going to do it, and so are you, because that's what's inside you, the spirit's inside you.
And you know what? There we have Billy Bowser, who's known as Bill Bowser. Obviously, this interview went way beyond my average of an hour and 10 minutes, but that because of the extraordinary experience and content and importance of what Billy had to say. To just not just us as a entrepreneurial masters group, but to this country, so I'm even if the professors say now, Richard, you yeah, that's over the top, and even if some of the people who start listening to this interview, they probably are gone by now, say that that's just, I just don't have the time for it. But America, I think Bill Bowser represents in his experience, America needs to take the time to listen to the Bill Bowsers of America, who are the true leaders of America, because they've done it, been there, like some of our teachers in the entrepreneurial group. They've done it, been there, and have the solutions that aren't that complex, however, somewhat creative. You have to go back to the future with a Bill Bowser to correct the situation. Will we do it? You know, as Billy would say, stay tuned. Bill Bowser, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, thousands of lives, and I gotta say, an honor to be one of my best friends, if not my best friend, and really with a final voice of optimism, even through his frustration with this country. And I really thank you for the time that you spent with me and the rest of the people who will be listening to me. You'll be getting a little questionnaire and stuff like that, but I will send it to you, and I'm going to stop recording now and thank you, Billy, very much.
Hey, absolutely.